Welcome to the Recombobulator Lab with Jason Gramnye and Chris Dominic.
Jason,
good morning, Chris.
Good morning. I hear surf and birds. I hear surf and birds.
My five-week work trip in Indonesia is never ending. And yes, we did move from Jakarta back to Bali. And
wow.
It is very, very pleasant. But we are doing some high-pressured work, and we felt we needed to be in a really pretty part of the world to do that. So yes, we're very lucky. But don't mind the birds.
No, I won't mind the birds. I might enjoy the birds. Has anybody asked you and Kim if you're married yet, just to, you know, double check?
Yeah. Oh. Because of the new laws?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. It
is so bizarre. I think it's illegal to have sex out of wedlock. Is that the new law?
Yeah, it is.
And because Bali's the number one Australian tourist destination, there's this whole extra element of, well, if you're a single guy or a girl up here and you have a casual hookup with someone up here and they're also single, does that mean you're going to jail for a year? It's quite fraught.
I can only imagine that there's a certain amount of people that go to Bali for casual hookups, right? I mean, like, it's supposed to be kind of a party spot, right?
It really is. So the next, it's going to be an interesting time.
Wow. Well, Jason, what are we doing today? What are we doing, actually?
We are welcoming Dr. Tani Kara, who is a PhD and senior research consultant at the University of Technology Sydney, which is where I'm doing some research as well. So we are known to each other. So welcome, Dr. Kara. How are you?
Many thanks, Jason. Thank you. And lovely to hear about your time in Bali and everything else and the background.
Sorry.
You did pique our interest, didn't you?
I know.
Yeah.
Sorry. So Dr. Kara has been so helpful for me in my research, but she is a PhD in cross-cultural consumption and human-animal interactions. It's so interesting.
Wow. Very cool. Well, Dr. Kara, I'm so curious. Can we start with a description of your PhD in layman's terms? Because that's a degree it's new to me.
Yeah, sure, Chris. So the PhD was, really just the title of the PhD was exploring meat consumption practices in Australia and India, more specifically Sydney and Mumbai, with a view towards encouraging reduced meat reduction. Mm-hmm. So what the research involved was sort of understanding meat consumption practices using sort of a framework from sociology called social practice theory, which I think Jason is also using as part of his PhD. So Jason's probably quite familiar with the framework. And we kind of sort of, I use this framework to really understand what drives meat consumption behavior in Australia and compare that to India. So they're two obviously very different countries in many different respects. I guess the key difference being that although I looked at urban cultures, but Australia is sort of, it's an individualistic society, whereas India is a collectivist culture. And meat itself in Australia has one of the world's highest levels of meat consumption. In 2021, it was sort of close to 100 kilograms per capita per annum.
Nice.
Sorry.
What's that?
Sorry.
As compared to the global average, actually, which is 35 kilograms per capita.
No.
The global average includes sort of, countries that are, it's sort of just all types of countries in terms of the economic trajectory and their consumption habits. Whereas India, on the other hand, the OECD reports that the meat consumption levels are only 4 kilograms per capita. But what's interesting about the country is because meat consumption is sort of the stigma associated with meat consumption. So this tends to be commonly underreported in surveys. Mm. That said, India, like China, like many developing economies, the sort of rates of meat consumption are rapidly on the rise. So although what we're finding that in countries like Australia and the US and parts of Europe, meat consumption has been at a historic high, but it's sort of peaked. Whereas it's the developing regions now, sort of the Middle East, Africa to some degree, and certainly Asia-Pac, and in fact, quite heavily Asia-backed, that we're finding rates of meat consumption rapidly rising with new emerging middle classes. And so this sort of the comparison across societies and cultures for this PhD, I thought was quite relevant.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah.
Can I ask a dumb question? What percentage of Indian, so many dumb questions coming your way. What percentage of India is reported as vegetarian?
Surprisingly, actually, it's about 25 to 30%.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's smaller than I would have expected, actually.
Yeah. And it's sort of 70% of India eats meat, and chicken and fish are the two most commonly consumed sources of animal protein. And as mentioned, it's sort of, highlighting that when it comes to really understanding meat consumption habits and practices, it's sort of numbers and surveys, etc. You tend to kind of want to look deeper behind sort of what's reported behind the official figures.
Another dumb question. Religion and vegetarianism. I'm a Muslim or I'm Hindu. Am I by definition vegetarian? No. God, that's a dumb question.
No, that's perfectly, that makes a lot of, because, there are facets, not all of Hinduism actually is against meat eating. There are aspects of Hinduism that allow meat eating, depending on sort of religion and custom. But commonly the common belief and practice is that if you are Hindu, you would sort of, it's sort of meat consumption is frowned upon. It's not allowed. Whereas Islam, like other Abrahamic religions, i.e. Christianity and Judaism, there's not really a taboo when it comes to sort of eating meat. There's certainly obviously taboo when it comes to eating certain types of meat like pork. But when it comes to eating meat, sort of goat meat and even beef, that's considered okay. Although that said, within India, there is sort of religious tension because particularly when it comes to eating beef, and which has resulted in sort of, communal violence against sort of certain minority populations. I think it's probably worth highlighting as well that what people may call sort of the hypocrisy, because India is actually one of the world's largest exporters. I think the second or the third largest exporter of beef, actually.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and that's what makes it sort of ironic, isn't it? So it's not sort of, it's this whole nationalistic right-wing religious protocol, and underneath that you've got sort of something else happening. So yeah, that's what makes this meat consumption within India and certainly other societies as well interesting and quite paradoxical.
Wow, that's fascinating. You know, for the listeners, I feel like I just should clarify one thing. Everyone, when you heard Jason just come out of his shoes talking about meat consumption, you may think to yourself, okay, he's just goofing around. But I can tell you as someone who has served Jason a steak that it's real. There, if you serve Jason a good steak, there will be nothing left at the end. He is a man who likes his meat. I'm just saying.
I know. But that 100 kilograms per capita for Australia is insane. A couple of comments. One is that, I mean, Australian beef exports are huge. And remembering, we do live exports of beef. Mm. Is that right, Dr. Cara?
Yes,
to the Middle
right.
East. And we do that for halal purposes? No. Why do we do that?
Actually, that's a good question. And yes, halal purposes is a factor. Mm-hmm. The freshness of meat and slaughtering of live cattle, and perhaps it may relate to halal, given that the Middle East is sort of an important trading partner for Australia, or rather an important sort of customer.
So for our, just to check in with our incredibly vast audience here, there are going to be some people who don't know what halal is either. So can we just do a quick primer on that one?
It's a certification, isn't it? For the how meat is treated before it's eaten. Is that right? Oh, not meat. Yes. It's all food. It's all food, right?
Yes, that's my. I'm not sort of an expert in halal, but yes, that's my understanding as well.
Okay.
So if you're Jewish, you'd want a kosher certified food,
right.
And if you're of the Muslim faith, you need it to be halal certified. So here in Indonesia, it's a big thing.
Got it.
One other thing. I just remember the export of or the consumption of beef in Japan soared through the 70s. And what happened was a lockstep increase in stomach cancer. And I think they might be number one or two today. Have you ever heard of that, Tane?
Yeah, actually, that's interesting because there are sort of reports about sort of Western diets in inverted commas and, you know, high levels of meat consumption. I mean, there's a lot of data already on, particularly when it comes to red meat consumption and its associations with all forms of obesity and diabetes and, you know, higher blood sugar levels and forms of cancer. And certainly, I mean, the WHO had put out a report about sort of processed red meat in particular, and the rise in carcinogens in processed red meat, and thus, of course, you know, creating high likelihood of cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's interesting stuff. I think just culturally, there's such non-meat eaters, and I think to throw that into their mix was just a huge shock. One of the things that emerged in your research was this idea that vegetarians secretly eating meat.
Yeah.
You told me that story. What's going on there? And is it like me sneaking chocolate so my kids and wife don't see me eating chocolate?
It's probably similar to that, Jason. So in India, and so this was an interesting topic which I explored as part of the PhD, was just the secret meat eating in India. And because there is such a taboo associated with meat consumption, which is where sort of there's opportunity potentially for plant-based meats, but we'll probably get to that topic later. There's such a taboo associated with meat consumption, and given sort of, you know, Hindu religious sentiment and stigma, I wrote a whole paper on the different ways in which secret meat eating occurs among different segments of people within urban Indian society. And it was just where people would sort of, they were expected to maybe abstain from meat on certain days of the week or during sort of religious festivals, or simply because meat was not allowed to be consumed in their homes. And so they'd find all sorts of ways to kind of eat meat, either at a restaurant, away from the family, on a work trip. Some respondents spoke about being meat eaters for several years and their vegetarian families not knowing. The interesting one was, it's a bit like being a smoker, but I guess with a smoker, you can kind of, yeah, it's maybe easier to detect. I'm not sure, but others spoke about when you're looking to rent in certain apartment buildings in Mumbai, in fact, the building body can mandate, you know, that they say non-vegetarians are not allowed. And so if you are sort of cooking meat within the apartment, you know, sort of the neighbors can kind of, and there's also that social ostracism as well that can take place and the social judgment. And so it was just about sort of cooking meat quietly within your apartments without the neighbors finding out as well. So it wasn't just an issue with friends and family, but it was also sort of trying to conform to the expectations of larger society, i.e. the neighbors and the collective community, which is what made it interesting, which, you know, especially when looking at these things within a collectivist culture, because there's so much sort of, I guess, you know, pressure to conform to sort of public and social norms. And in this case, this relates to sort of having the right eating practices and following, of course, as part of sort of larger social practices.
So I thought maybe I could take us to the universe of reasons why people might want to eat a meat substitute, because this is adding to, I think, many people's understanding, right? Some people are doing this because they simply want to be healthier, and there's evidence that this is, you know, eating meat's bad for you at some level. The second reason I'm hearing is there's religious reasons to not eat meat for certain people. The third one that I've heard is, Jason, I'm sure you know, there's a lot of arguments around environmentalism and reducing the amount of cows in the world because of interesting things like bovine flatulence. But then there's also just some people who want to be good to the animals, right? They just want to make sure that they're not doing anything to harm other life forms. Is that sound like all of the reasons why some company might say, it's time for me to make a meat substitute because there's a demand out there? Or is there something we're missing?
Yeah, you've covered actually, those reasons. So it's okay. Pretty much sort of environmental, health-related and animal welfare. These three tend to be sort of the top reasons. Mm-hmm. There are sort of other factors like, you know, when it comes to sort of vegetarianism, and again, that differs between East and West. But yeah, those three reasons tend to be the top reasons in general.
So why is there a struggle in that world then? It seems to me like we've just set up a situation where the people making meat substitute foods would be doing very, very well, and yet the premise of the episode is that they're not.
Well, they were. What's going on? They were doing so great, so Impossible Foods and others. So this is protein-based meat, just to be clear, because we want to get onto cell-based in a minute. But this is protein-based meat. So, Tani, what's a description of protein-based meat? What would you make meat out of if it's not the four-legged thing in the farm?
Yeah, so, I mean, the difference is soy is quite a common ingredient. So there's soy, there's also legumes and pea protein as well. Mm-hmm. The other types of is also mycoprotein, where you've got sort of, it's essentially fermented fungus, which is what corn is made out of. So that's Q-U-O-R-N.
Oh, yeah. Mm. That brand.
And that's been around for a while. So that's sort of typically what plant-based meats are made of.
Got it. So $5 billion goes into this industry, probably more, and Impossible Foods is probably one of the bigger brands. They're selling these plant-based meats to Burger King and McDonald's, and it's going amazingly. And then you and I spoke about 6 or 8 months ago, and they'd fallen out of bed. And one of the things is, what's happening there?
Yeah, actually, it's still within, I guess, I was looking at other reports as well. It's sort of like there was a lot of hype attached to the sector and a lot of expectation, a lot of attention given. And I think what's happened is that sector is still probably growing because meat consumption and the animal livestock industry, i.e. animal agriculture, is actually not going to be sustainable, now and in the long term. So there'll always probably be a place for sort of meat alternatives. It's just that there was so much hype and attention attached to this sector. And it's kind of like, it sort of feels like when looking at other reports that things are starting to sort of normalize. Mm. Rather than all the excitement and all of that that we saw around the sector. So when looking at some of the figures from, the Vegan Society in the UK and looking at the European figures and some of the figures here in Australia as well, they're still showing healthy growth. It's still, I think there were figures sort of in 2026, there was a projection in 2030. There's still a projection of sort of fairly healthy growth. It's just that even when, with the sort of COVID pandemic, we started to see, the rise of sort of plant-based meat sales because people were sort of worried about, just contamination in these meat markets, these wet meat markets. So it does feel like that there is a space for it, but it feels like some of the hype and glitz and, the massive attention and all of that seems to be kind of petering out and it's sort of starting to normalize.
Right.
So would an analogy be something like what happened to Peloton during the pandemic, where everybody's buying bikes, everybody gets excited because nobody can go and work out at their gym anymore. And so Peloton has this huge growth. They make a bunch of orders with their suppliers. And then about the time those orders come in, people stop ordering the service. Mm-hmm. Is it sort of like that where, there's still a lot of demand. It's just that there was a presumption that the demand would be even larger than it now is.
Yeah, it's sort of, it generally sort of feels like that.
Okay.
That said, like during the pandemic, it was interesting that, and since the pandemic, we've found that people have started to, particularly in places like the UK, where, given sort of the crazy inflation there, people have started to buy sort of more in bulk and they've started to buy more sort of raw foods. Mm. They're not looking at sort of more expensive packaged foods, which is what a lot of plant-based meats are. So people are sort of almost starting to go back to the basics. Mm. But that said, what we also saw was certain reports that came out, like the Mintel reports, show that the meat sales had sort of slightly dropped as well.
Right.
In Europe particularly, focusing on sort of the UK, just given sort of the state of the current economic state there. And then, of course, post-pandemic elsewhere.
Right. If I'm a vegetarian, do I look at plant-based burger at Burger King and go, oh, heck yeah? Or do I throw up and go, that's disgusting. That's made in a lab. What would I do? Mm-hmm. can you represent all vegetarians in that answer, please?
Actually, the plant-based and mycoprotein and that sort of whole cultured meat was really not targeted at the vegan and vegetarians, actually. Because, I mean, relatively speaking, they're quite a small percentage. Like within Australia, 20% identify as flexitarian and about 12% identify as sort of being plant-based. So that's sort of 12% of the population. And sort of it's slowly, gradually growing, but it's a very small percentage compared to the overall population. And certainly, I would imagine it's the case in the US and parts of Europe as well. And certainly in India, you know, which is sort of has relatively higher rates of, you know, plant-based consumption as compared to other Western societies. So you've just got this big chunk of meat eaters and flexitarians, and the plant-based companies are sort of targeting them more than the vegans and vegetarians, because actually for vegans and vegetarians within this community, you've got sort of discussions between Whole Foods, going for Whole Foods versus plant-based meats, and that's another argument altogether. And then there are sort of different forms of kind of plant-based eating within the community. So it's not really meant for people who are already plant-based. I mean, yes, that is a market as well, but these guys are sort of targeting the people sitting on the fence, i.e. the large number of flexitarians and meat eaters.
Right. So
that's fascinating.
If I'm a red hot meat eater, oh gosh, I am, and I rock into McDonald's and get my quarter pounder with cheese, but it's made from mushroom-based meat, would I be doing that because I want to save the planet, or would I be doing that because I like the furry animals? Is there a really clear split? Like, is it 50-50 or is it one way or the other?
Actually, it's looking at meat eaters who want to be at sort of the flexitarian meat eater, at sort of the flexitarian. So say on a certain day, you kind of want to, you know, cut back on eating meat. So you want to sort of give maybe the digestive system a rest, or maybe you feel for the animals on that particular day. So that's when you'd sort of go, you know, I'd maybe sort of switch from meat and I'd have sort of the plant-based burger. So this is actually, there's an advertisement from Domino's, which I've been seeing recently, and it's called the Impossible Pizza Night.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you've seen that advertisement. Yeah, so it's kind of, they sort of show this group of kids, and one of the kids orders a pizza, and she sort of goes that, hey, but I thought we were going to go meat-free tonight. And the other kid goes, yes, we are going meat-free, and so we can have our pizza and eat it too, essentially. So it's called the Impossible Pizza Night. So you can have your pizza with and enjoy the taste of meat, but without actually having meat on that particular night.
In America, some people have a meatless Monday practice.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
That's interesting.
But of course, that's followed by Taco Tuesday. So it kind of cancels it out a little bit. But, you know, I mean, you got to do it sometime. You know, Jason, have you experimented with something other than bacon in the morning? I'm just curious.
I really can't do it. I have a big problem. I just feel this is terrible, but I just feel like anything grown in a, this is so flawed and cognitive dissonance, but I get really freaked out about it. The other version is cell-based meat. So that's meat that's grown from the cells of a cow, and that's now coming on big. In the textile industry, you've got vegan leather. So that's leather made from mushrooms. For some reason, I just get freaked out ingesting food made in a laboratory, which is ridiculous because meat is so processed. It's stupid. But anyway. Are you into it, Chris? Do you do meat-free Monday?
It's interesting. I'm of two minds on all this. I am firmly of the belief that overall, beef in particular, is probably not something you ever need to eat. I just happen to like it. So I just reduce my consumption of it. But I have heard some incredibly smart people with credentials, like the good doctor here, who have said things to vegetarians, like, look, if you eat, you know, good meat and you eat it from good sources and, you know, all this sort of thing, you know, you can really, you can do a lot with your workouts and you can do a lot with your health. And there are some people who push back and they say part of the problem isn't eating beef. They say it's eating mass produced beef or, right, it's because you didn't know what the name of the cow was and the farmer who grew it. And so it's unclear, I think, really. But I do think there's a strong argument for, has this thing been processed or not? And I think that's the interesting conundrum you're pointing out, which is, what if you're doing this for reasons where you're trying to make the planet better, you're trying to not hurt animals as much, and in the meantime, you're consuming basically a laboratory, which it seems a little weird going along with that, you know? I mean, I had a friend who was a vegetarian who wore a leather jacket, and I was kind of okay, you know?
Okay.
So, yeah, I guess, so I don't know what to say there. I mean, it's a conundrum, and it's one of those things that I think we all wrestle with, because we all want to do what's better for the planet and what's better for us. I'll tell you, just coming from my background, watching people try to reconcile their cognitive dissonance around these issues is the most entertaining for me. Like, listening to people talk about how important it is to eat, like how good beef is for you, is always kind of entertaining for me, because I'm sitting there watching them thinking, okay, we all just know that you really like beef, and for some reason you have a hard time saying, but I just really like it, even though it's probably not that good for me, right? So I think that's the interesting thing in my world, is just watching people manage it in their own mind. I don't know.
No.
Doctor, if that's a big curveball. I don't know if you dabble into any of the way people justify this, but it seems to me if you're dealing with people, if you're studying the behavior of people sneaking meat, you're probably a little into that territory, right?
Yeah, and you make a really good point, Chris, because, you know, it's such a controversial topic, and there's so many different perspectives on this. In fact, you know, in Europe, they were looking at a meat tax. I'm not sure whether that sort of came about, but there are sort of papers and articles and reports and sort of a meat tax, given that it is an environmentally friendly and an environmentally unfriendly food.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout sort of the literature, there's been kind of discourse about just how, about just sort of pushback from people, because attacks around something that is so personal to someone, you know, consumption is such a personal thing that, you know, sort of, I guess politicians everywhere have kind of been, you know, quite reluctant to impose attacks on consumption, essentially, because it's just such a personal thing.
Yeah. I don't know what people would do in Australia, Jason, but I can think of a revolution that might occur in America if you suddenly put a tax on certain forms of meat, or if you banned it outright. There'd be places where, you know, people would pick up their pitchforks and charge. There are certain places in America where the diet is almost exclusively, you know, meat and potatoes, because we were settled by British people and Irish people and German people, and that's what they ate.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Thanksgiving would be very contentious if that turkey was costing me more.
If it was a tofurkey.
Oh my God, not a tofurkey. You can't do tofurkey. That is illegal. Tani, I do want to get a little bit personal with you. What did you have for breakfast, and have you ever worn leather shoes?
Actually, Jason, you know, I grew up in a meat-eating household. My family, they eat practically everything that moves, and still do. I'm the odd one out, and I think I started getting into it after I started finding out about 10 years ago. Just, you know, where does the chicken on your plate come from? So I actually grew up eating everything, and there was a documentary from sort of Mercy for Animals, which is that large animal welfare NGO, and they produced a documentary a couple of 10 years ago. Actually, it's called From Farm to Plate, and I saw that, and I was just like, you know. For a week, I was...
By the way, anybody who really wants a little help getting over the vegetarian line, just watch any documentary that involves chicken processing or slaughterhouses or anything. It is so much easier to do after you've seen that.
That's true.
So,
and Tani, Tani, to be clear, you're bicultural. So you are raised in Australia and born in Australia. Is that right?
Well, actually, I was born in India, raised in Singapore, and now living in Australia.
Got it. Yeah. So you are the United Nations. Got it.
Well, I'm realizing our time's up. We've got to ask, Doctor, is there any myths that you'd like to bust? We ask people this on the show. There's probably myths you come across all the time. What's a big one you can share with us?
I don't know, where do I start, actually? I don't know whether it's worth highlighting sort of a recent study we had done. So this was with the ISF, the place that I work, the Institute for Sustainable Futures. And we had done the study where we looked at sort of, we synthesized sort of 12 life cycle assessment studies across different types of foods. And just some interesting facts here was our findings show that, you know, replacing just 25% of beef with plant-based alternatives, say you walk into a McDonald's and, you know, you choose sort of your plant-based burger instead of beef. And so if people, if just replacing 25% of beef with plant-based alternatives, say if it was done across the population, that would be equivalent to taking 150,000 cars off the road.
Mm-hmm.
It would be equivalent to saving water that's equivalent to 5,200 Olympic swimming pools.
Wow.
And it would actually save in terms of land area. So that would be about 35,000 Melbourne Cricket Ground stadiums.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, wow.
So this was modeling which the team, which we'd done recently. And I just think in terms of sort of myth is sort of one thing, but even just sort of examining, you know, the potential difference that one can make by just sort of, by just that 25% replacement of beef with plant-based alternatives, it makes such a big difference in terms of water saving, energy saving, and land saving. So I kind of just, wanted to, just put this out there.
That's fascinating. Because
it is absolutely.
So many problems with sustainability is the individual saying, well, what can I do? You know, how can my choice really impact the greater? But that's a great data point.
Absolutely. Mm. Yes, that's very interesting. Thank you so much for being on the program, Dr. Carr. We really appreciate your insight and the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. And it's 6 o'clock here in Bali, and I'm about to have breakfast, and I'm contemplating a faux meat bacon sandwich.
You better take a picture if that happens.
I will.
I'm not going to believe you. All right.
Thanks, Tani.
Bye,
we so appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us at the Recombobulator Lab with Chris Dominic and Jason Graham Nye. Catch you next time.